Hello, everybody. This is Thomas from Celestina's podcast. It is a podcast for everybody who wants to invest, who wants to build startups, who wants to be in touch with what is happening in the health tech and med tech arena. So that's for all of you who are into healthcare and want to make an impact, grow it big. I'm Thomas, and with me is also Yevgeny, my co-host, who is the head of corporate venture fund of Intersystems and a co-founder of Celestino. So hi, Yevgeny. It's nice to have you here. Hello.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Tomas. Yes, and let me introduce Tomas, my co-host on this Digital Health Celestino's podcast. Tomas is an innovator, influencer and angel investor in digital health sphere, and also the co-founder of Celestino's digital health incubator. And we are very pleased to announce our guest today. It's Alan Gobbs. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Evgeny.
Alan is a venture investor, co-founder and managing partner of ATEM Capital. And let's get it started. And Alan, maybe you can share some background. Where you are now. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Tomas. Thank you, Evgeny. It's a pleasure to be here at this podcast and share some insights with your fantastic audience here. So I'm excited to dive into topics today. I promise to try to keep it fun and interesting. However, it's a like really tough topics which we'll be discussing today. Hopefully, some sharp questions. So yeah, unless you tune in here to help with insomnia, well, in that case, you're more than welcome to. But you know, we'll dive into this, and I'll start with a brief introduction of myself. So on my side, I'm a venture investor and deep tech entrepreneur. I'm investing exclusively in life sciences space, which is biotech, medtech, diagnostics, and also digital health, obviously. It's more recent development. So we previously invested primarily into late stage biopharma. And we're based in New York, where all the late stage deals come over basically to fundraise. But over like the last probably 3 to 5 years, especially over the last 3 years, obviously due to COVID, we really dived into health tech investments. So this is kind of the story, what we're doing. Yeah, and I'm glad to like get through like your questions. Hopefully you get something prepared and something really sharp.
Alan, please. I'm of humble origin. And when I remember my childhood, and if my parents asked me, what do you want to do in life? You know, the best I could come up with was astronaut. And of course, I could never see myself as a VC investor, for example. Was it similar to, or how did you happen to become a VC investor? What was your trajectory in life that brought you here? Was it your childhood dream to invest in startups and sign term sheets and do exits?
Sounds really exciting job. Thank you. Like reviewing the term sheets, especially. That's the best part of the business. Yeah. So basically, you know, I got into this industry by mistake, like not on my side, hopefully, but on the side of the employer. So basically, I was initially an investment banker for many years, for over 10 years. I was working at Barclays Capital. I was working at Dresdner Kleinwort. That was such a bank, was acquired by Commerzbank at some point. I was an investment banker, and I would say that, well, in the very kind of early in my life, I dreamed of like creating, well, I would not say startups or companies. I dreamed of creating some products which will, you know, probably change the world. So I had this ambition, but then, you know, and I hope to become a scientist, whatever, but I didn't. So eventually I became, I get my education from the side of the investment. And then I went to Harvard Business School and to INSEAD to like develop more in the corporate finance. So I don't have, by the way, I don't have any medical device, any scientific background initially, at least. So, and then again, and that's why probably this was a mistake, but my kind of a partner and to some degree employer basically invited me to become a managing partner of a $500 million venture firm. That's crazy. It's a large pot of cash. And to invest it into the US, into biotech, the industry which I didn't know. Before that, I worked for 5 years in the healthcare space, like making deals, like M&As, like selling plants, producing pharmaceuticals, something like that. And all of a sudden, I was invited because the employer said, well, you know investments, right? You were in the healthcare, right? Right. So why not you just join the firm and be investing into the US in biotech? And I thought maybe I will join and work for a couple of months, and then they will understand that I'm completely unprofessional. I don't know anything about that space. So I joined. It was really tough times, so I learned a lot. I actually didn't sleep for first probably 6 months. I was reading. I was like learning. The good thing was that this was investment into a portfolio of a venture firm called Domain Associates, which is one of the oldest venture firms in the U.S., which actually created the whole industry of investment into biotech, diagnostics, and all of the space. So we were not supposed to invest outside of their portfolio. So that's the way I avoided early mistakes as an investor. So we invested only into pre-selected companies, which were the best in the world, the best in the US. My benchmark, my bar, what I have to invest into really raise substantially. I was really looking at the best portfolios. And then within this 70 companies of their portfolio, I still picked some of them. So kind of was choosing among the best and was saying, well, this is not good enough for us to invest in. Kind of, we invest into 10 companies out of their portfolio. And because they were pre-selected, because they were best in the world, out of this 10 companies, actually 10 companies plus one outside of their portfolio, which I invest in the first fund, which I was managing, we get 5 IPOs and 3 M&As out of this 11 companies which we invested already. And we actually expect more from this portfolio. So this was very successful for me, very successful start. And of course, when you're like coming to the US with $500 million in your pocket, all of a sudden you get very like interesting for everybody. So I was invited to all the podcasts, all the conferences as a panel speaker. So all of a sudden I became a rock star of life sciences. So again, it was really luck for me. And it's really hard to replicate such a journey. And we can always discuss how I think could be a way to get into the space. But generally speaking, this was really great luck for me. And I learned a lot from this like first 2-3 years. And then after 2 years working as a managing partner of this fund, I started my own firm, Aiton Capital, back in 2014. This year, by the way, exactly like in July, we'll like celebrate our 10th anniversary of our fund. So that's my story.
Fantastic, yes. This sounds like sometimes we need lucky mistakes.
Yes, on the side of the employers, right?
You don't look like a person that do not sleep for a long time.
No longer.
Yeah, so, but my next question will be, okay, this is a digital health podcast, right? And of course, our listeners are very curious about, are there any specifics in, how is it like to invest in digital health? So are there any like different philosophy or whatever? Yeah.
Right. So I think that, firstly, you have to be very humble. The worst thing you actually learn out of your kind of journey that unfortunately, when the companies which you think are absolute wins, they fail. And then the ones which you think would fail, they actually win. And you can never really make a projection and actually like you will always make mistakes in the space because this is too complicated and there are too many variables which you have to take into account to succeed. So you have to be humble and you have to treat it as a poker game. So I called it a poker game because you have to you have to build your chances to win, but you never know that you will actually win. And you have to build a portfolio of investments which, like, all in all, in your portfolio, this will actually work. And, you have to diversify it. Maybe you will have some companies which you think are truly exciting, but have less chance to succeed. But then the reward has to be much larger, right? So you have to balance your portfolio and find a way how you basically evaluate companies. And the way we evaluate, we have a framework, which I'm actually teaching as also I'm a kind of educator in the space as well. So the framework says basically that you have to go through all of these elements of value creation in our space. And when you begin to play this poker, you know, you got like, you know, initial like couple of cards which seem similar to you, and you say, well, I have a great combination. So that's the way you start playing poker. And at some point you understand with just two cards, you will never win. You have to have like, you know, a combination of five cards, a very clever combination, like Royal Flush, for example. So something, you know, and at some point your bar of investment raises so high that you invest only in Royal Flushes, right? So you have like really the best, like best by far best combination of cards. And then only this combination you think may actually win, even though it may fail as well. But still, the chances are, you know, say 5% instead of 2%. And, you know, like, you know, I would say people who are not in the space, it's very hard for you to think of things which have like 5% chance or 2% chance of success. Because normally in our lives, you know, we do some efforts and it's like 90%, you know, this will happen. Especially in the corporate lives, when you work in the corporate space. So it's all like 50-50, whatever. So it's not 2 to 5% of your efforts will actually succeed. So you have to adjust your mentality, adjust your mind to be successful, and you have to build a portfolio. And then, of course, you have to go through each of those elements of success. So it's like, you know, technology. You know, in technology, there's always a regulatory part of it. There's also like scaling part, and there are many other parts in that. And then intellectual property. Without intellectual property, everything is worthless. It's just science, nothing. It's not even an innovation. And then, of course, the markets, the clinical benefit. In our case, this is unmet needs, clinical benefit, a very different way how you evaluate startups compared to some other industries. And then, of course, the team is very important. And you cannot invest into somebody who never did this before. So you have to look and like really look through the backgrounds and don't make mistakes as the one which my employee did. And finally, yes, you have to look at like how much you have to raise to make it a success. Sometimes it's just the funding which you need is actually just impossible to raise in the current circumstances, in the current markets, for example, or generally for this particular product. And then of course the final stage, you look at this at the exit strategy, whether like this type of investments are being acquired at all. So all of that, everything is very important. There's no element which is not important. So you have to look into each of those and really you know, think it through and not get excited about the science, not get excited about the market opportunity, not get excited about just whatever IP or the team. So you have to look through all of this systematically and like with a like really good discipline, investment discipline, and then once you see a Royal Flush, you will feel it, and you will understand that you have to get into this transaction by any means. You have to meet the founder. You have to like you have to persuade the founder to get your money. And normally, when you get a Royal Flush, you know that's you who would be pitching this founder to take your money. That's you know, normally the case when we like work with some of our like really amazing founders. We make friends with them, by the way.
Alan, that's it's what I wanted to ask about. This is it VCs chasing startups or startups chasing VCs? And you answered that if it's a real potential unicorn or whatever is the next level animal. And you know, I've heard of zebras and unicorns. I wonder what the next stage will be if there is a you know, 1 trillion startup maybe in the future could be. What name or which animal would you pick?
Yeah, so firstly, you have to look at them and look for trends. You know, it's amazing, and sometimes it's very frustrating for some founders. They say, well, we're not like part of the hype, you know, we're fundamental, we're doing the right thing, so we'll not be like adjusting our pitch. You know, now we heard like there's a COVID outside there. We'll not adjust our pitch for this COVID times. We'll not adjust our pitch for whatever, for AI, obviously, like the current trend or multi-omics or whatever. So we'll be doing the right thing until we succeed. And I would say that it's inappropriate and shows that the founder is not flexible. They will probably have issues with hiring people, because people also are following trends. And if you want to hire scientists or, you know, data scientists or whoever, you would not hire them unless your startup is really in the trend, basically. And then, of course, you know, if you're not hiring the best people, you're not doing the best product, and then you can't fundraise, and then you can't exit, because the corporates, they will only acquire something which they cannot replicate. So when they see there's a new trend emerging and they need to like rapidly develop that, and there's already available innovation in the space, they would acquire you very early. But otherwise, if it's nothing, there's no pressure, like no timing pressure for a corporate to acquire a startup, you know, they will say, okay, let's see how they will manage to sell. And if they manage to sell their products, then we'll probably add this to our portfolio. And then they will not pay the high price for you, and they will pay you in a very, like, at a very late stage. And for a startup to succeed in sales, it's much harder than to develop the right technology or the trendy technology. So you have to think about that. And then, you know, this is first thing. Again, we'll go through our poker game. So we check the combination, obviously. So it's very disciplined. But again, it has to be like in line with the current trends. Otherwise, this will, you know, it will have a hard time at each step of the development of the startup. The trends have to be like really long. So and also you have to make sure that they can adjust to new trends emerging, because sometimes we'll have VR, sometimes we'll have whatever stem cells or neurotech, like brain computer interfaces will be a trend, like which everybody can do. Now it's only Elon Musk can do that or somebody who has money. But at some point this will like be commoditized and will be open to many more startups, many more entrepreneurs, all of these like crazy, like capital intensive, I would say, opportunities. So you have to be like looking like really open, be open-minded and readily like look at the new trends emerging and put this into your startup in the right way, obviously, not like crazy way, but something which makes sense. Because normally these technologies are really transformative for the whole industry. It's not like very small, like chunk of something. It's really something which transformative for the whole industry. If you're not part of the industry and you're not transformed by the latest trends, it means you're not flexible enough. You're just stubborn. You're just pushing the thing, which is probably dated. Maybe it's already 5-10 years ago, like this technology. So it's just dated.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that you have to be in line with the latest trends. You need to have all the elements of this startup pitch deck. You know, every slide needs to be there, and only the combination somehow counts. This is pretty like standard stuff. I mean, you hear it everywhere. Everybody tells you this, but what is maybe the element? If I were pitching to you right now, what would convince you to set up another meeting? Maybe would it be? Is it always the founder, or is it some secret ingredient, or is it maybe me not following just the trends, but thinking ahead of trends, because the investment life cycle in health tech or med tech or biotech is quite long compared to, say, retail, gadget, I don't know. It could be like, you know, 10 years and more. So you really need to somehow be able to predict or to see what future holds and kind of steer towards the world that is 10 years from now, or maybe longer. So what's something that gets not mentioned? What's your personal secret sign or rule of thumb which would make me get another follow-up meeting with you as a VC?
Well, I would say that if you like, try to like say just in one single sentence, I would say that that's the feeling where you feel that you speak the same language, you know, with the team. And you basically, again, you know, they you see based on your communication, based on the pitch itself, based on the material, you see that they're not missing something. So they understand what they have to build. And then they're building this really like 24/7. And that's what really excites me. I know that I would not replicate this energy because I'm investing in many companies, not just one. I love this energy. And I love that it's all done very smart, and then you understand that they know the game, so and then you kind of you will start like testing them on each card, you know, what are you doing with this and then with that, and then you see that they know all of that, they're building that, and I know that, and they know what they're missing, by the way, in their game, in the combination, and they're not hiding that. They're putting this inside the pitch, like straight away in front of you, that, you know, we're building this and that, and this is where the part which we want to build based on the funding we're getting from you. So this is really exciting, and this is I hate hard pitches. You know, somebody's telling like we're the best, you know, like, and just pitching and pitching. Sometimes the energy is good, and sometimes it's fine. Such a pitch sometimes work, but still, like, substance wise, you should feel that this kind of a discussion, and we're all on the same page, and we know what we need to build and how I can contribute to that and help with my contacts, with whatever, and with, you know, among investors, potential strategic partners. So all of that, yes, this kind of energy and this understanding and common language, this is what I'm looking for. And well, but I mostly work with very skilled and experienced founders. So I invest late stage, and these guys, they know their job. They did like 3 exits before. So you know, we speak the same language, obviously. So we, like, I would say maybe there will be a different advice for some early stage startups. But again, the team and the skill set and the kind of the mind, that the open-mindedness when they realize that they're missing something and they're ready to, okay, that's a great meeting. We understood that we're missing this point. We'll change our pitch. We'll adjust it. We'll solve the issue which you just mentioned. And we'll, and I've seen a lot of startups, which I really loved, when after our first meeting, they transformed. And I was so impressed that I put a check in a few like this, when, you know, they listened to me, they actually ignored some of my advice, and they explained why, or didn't even explain that you don't have to explain if you ignore my advice. But then I saw that some of the advice was actually followed, and I truly appreciated that, because I saw that they saw value in that, and they implemented that. That's really impressive and helpful.
Mm-hmm. Alan, actually, I thanks for that. I really like this game analogy, and maybe my next question would be, how is it important to play poker regularly for a venture investor? But actually, the question is, again, following this poker analogy, and it's clear that team. Having a great team is a very strong card in this hand, right? But speaking on other strong cards, what do you think if in digital health, if the partnership with the ecosystem, with different vendors, or like joining incubator? I don't want to advertise very much Listinos incubator, but the question will be, is it important for a startup to really get into incubation, or and should they do that earlier, on in which stage? So what do you think about this ecosystem, incubation, accelerator topics? Are they important for startups and in digital health especially, and is it makes this hand in towards the royal flesh in the following year?
Well, I would say this is an absolutely critical card. Critical, really. It's not like nice to have. This is absolute necessity in the digital health space. So, I'm not even like exaggerating. I mean, it's. I think it's like, I should even say it's stronger. Maybe I'm lacking the words to say it's even stronger, because I cannot highlight it more. But the thing is that the unfortunate part of that, part of the digital health space, is that not the best product wins. That's very, like, you learn that, you know, when you start pitching like major health systems, you come to them, you say, well, I know personally as an entrepreneur, I know my product, which measures like blood pressure, is by far better than anything which just comes from Abbott, from other players. It's by far better than any startups, anything in the development. It's just crazily great, like, solution to measure your blood pressure. Who cares? You know, unfortunately, maybe there'll be not like this. There'll be not like, you know, there'll be some whatever, the watch of a wrist or something which measures everything in your body. Maybe this will be just an app which measures everything by your face. And there are startups like that. But the thing is that the product wins and the team wins, which has more integrations and more context within the ecosystem of digital health, especially with major health systems, especially with big players, corporates, like obviously Intel systems, like big tech guys like Google, Amazon, whoever is now entering the space, retail players like Best Buy and others, and of course, big pharma, med tech, diagnostic companies, diagnostic laboratories. So all of these, if you don't have these relationships, unfortunately, this is sometimes even number one differentiator. So unless you have these partnerships, unless you manage to build these partnerships, you basically would not win. And investors understand that, and they will not invest. It's the primary differentiator. It's funny, you know, you think about the product, about whatever IP you build around that. But if you don't have these relationships, unfortunately, you will fail. And early traction showing that even in the very at the very early stage, you are capable of building these relationships. And then later stage as well, showing that you get some interest from the industrial groups, it means a lot. It means that you would eventually be acquired, and it means that you have the validation from the acquirers. If you really want to build a multi-billion company, sometimes I saw actually entrepreneurs who would say, well, what incubators, accelerators? What are you saying? You know, I'm building a multi-billion company, you know, that I will be just like making sales, and then based on my sales, they will acquire me. And they feel like, you know, like accelerators is just for fun. However, not all accelerators are equal. And I would really when you look into the incubators, accelerators, I would choose them based on like probably two criteria, just on the spot. So first criteria is that they're not taking too much equity from you, like Y Combinator does. You know, maybe you heard such accelerator, I don't know. I heard Y Combinator, I think there was somebody. But I think that sometimes the deals are not too fair, at least if you're a super professional. If you're like starting, if you're like early stage entrepreneur, like first time entrepreneur, that's a great incubator. But if you're already skilled and you come from whatever, from big player, from big corporate, you already know the game. So you may not benefit from that. So first thing, not selling too much equity. Or if you're selling that, be it a safe, so a safe without a cap. So if there are a lot of incubators, by the way, like your fund, like InterSystems also providing this as a safe without a cap. That's, and actually even more, so basically you join the rounds from external investors, so they validate the terms and you don't like push for whatever 5% in the company at the very beginning. So it may not work for many startups. And second point is that if you choose an accelerator or incubator, I would advise you only to choose those which are part of the major corporates. So not like really not like this, again, there's one which I just mentioned. It doesn't make sense. You know, it's better to be part of your ecosystem. So you're part of Mayo Clinic, part of Illumina, part of InterSystems, part of Dell Technologies, part of, you know, any other player at the very early stage. And then with such a partner, you will develop much faster. So I think whatever is most fit, the most relevant to your product, to your startup, and choose wisely the incubator with the corporate, which will potentially further down the road will acquire you. And then, of course, make sure that you're not like giving away too much equity at the early stage, especially, you know, too much equity to those who doesn't have any affiliation with major corporates. Why would you do so, you know? So there's no promise they would invest into you or acquire down the road. So why would you give away whatever 5 to 10% just to people who would not be involved later on?
Alan, thanks for this advice. And if I'm now a startup founder and listening to you, I say, that's interesting. So now I may not be sure whether I am mature enough for interview with you regarding investment. So what stage in the life of a startup do you prefer? Do you focus on really early stage, just an idea, prototype, first paying customers, or a startup before certification? That often is a major hurdle for those startups that, for example, recruited from our hackathons. There is a good team. They start doing something, and then suddenly they realize they need to spend hundreds of thousands dollars on, you know, getting certified, you know, building an actual industrial version of the nice gadget that has AI and can actually be used in hospitals. So which stage do you focus on? How do you think about investing in different stages of a startup?
Yeah, so our strategy is the following. Basically, we invest like 20% early stage biopharma, and then like 50% late stage biopharma. And that's what our sweet spot is. We invest in primarily late stage biopharma. And then the rest, 30% of the fund, we do invest into digital health. And by the way, this is kind of a dated way of strategy. Now we're changing that because like probably 5 years ago, you would have to diversify your strategy within a fund. Currently, funds are really very focused. So we will actually have two funds. One would be only digital health and only biotech. And if we talk about health tech investments, we primarily, biopharma, it's late stage, it's data, it's like data in the humans when we like to invest. In health tech, we're actually looking at things earlier than that. However, I would say, would not invest until you have a product which is developed. So you have a developed product, it's already just like software, like application, a gadget, so it actually works. We know that. And then, as opposed to some other VC groups, we do invest before you have revenues because we understand the company. We understand the industry. We understand your product. We understand the potential of your product, and we can get engaged earlier than some other VCs who are actually looking for the first customers. Like, you know, they're looking for basically, you know, product market fit. We are ready to invest earlier than that because, you know, to our case, we can review that. We say, well, this will actually have clinical benefit. This we can evaluate that. We don't need to test, you know, the market. If it helps you like overcome some oncology side effects, you know, oncology drugs side effects, or like maybe some other things like or stick to your medicine. And we know that the clinical benefit is huge and it's a matter of valuation. So maybe when you get this, you know, product market fit, the valuation will be much higher than currently. So why not get engaged right now with a very small check? We invest small checks in the health tech businesses at early stage, up to like $500,000 probably. Well, we officially up to $1 million. I think we did invest more than $500,000 in one company. But generally speaking, initial investment would be like very small, like say, I would say up to $500,000, maybe like up to $750,000. And then we'll keep the reserves to support the company over its journey. We may actually invest, and we did invest in some startups more than we did invest as our initial check. So we kind of be in the company. We now know the story. We're insiders. And then at some point, we see that the company is getting so much traction. And it's kind of proven that the team works, everything works. Let's put much more money into this, more than pro rata investment, which like compared to the one we did before. So like really a larger check. We write a larger check at a later stage. We can do that, which is also, by the way, unusual for some other venture groups.
Mm-hmm. Alan, thank you so much. And thanks for sharing so much, so many insights. I hope digital health startups, early digital health startups are all here and listening to all of them. It's very important. Thank you. And of course, like in the venture investment business, there are a lot of exciting processes, but all of them, they hopefully lead to like exits, and ideally, with these magic animals, unicorns, right? And we heard that recently, ATM Capital, you had an exit. Maybe you can share some details.
Oh yeah, sure. So firstly, the most successful investment of ours was early stage investment. Again, our sweet spot is late stage, but the most successful deal we made so far was an early stage investment into a company called ATF Pharmaceuticals. So it's biopharma. And then the CEO started two companies before that. So one company he sold for $11 billion, another second company sold for $4 billion. And then this was his third company in the same industry, in the same indication. So I'm always joking that he knew the monkeys where he will be testing these drugs. So by name, so basically. So with that, obviously, you know, we were attracted by that. We knew that he knows the story to the very end. He knows who he will sell this company to. And we invested at $10 million pre-money valuation, by the way, $10 million. Again, basically a founder who did two exits, 11 billion, 4 billion. And then he starts his third company. And you would expect him like to throw like it's 100 million kind of valuation at the very beginning. So no, it's in the market. We didn't negotiate that. He just said 10 million pre-money. That's it. I want my investors to win. That was great. So we invested and this was actually oversubscribed, obviously Series A. We did that. And then it went public at 2.2 billion in 6 years time frame. And then it went to like almost 7 billion. So it's like, you know, 700 times basically. The valuation grew over 6-7 years. We exited, we get 40 times on this one based on all the dilution because we invested only in the Series A in this case. So yeah, 40 times is 42 times actually. It's great for an investor. This is a great exit in our space within 7 years. And the most recent exit we did was March this year. The company was called Emolit. And this company used AI basically. So what they did, they looked at the rare diseases, which, you know, we humans have. It's 7,000 diseases actually, rare diseases. Most of them still doesn't have any drug to tackle, like to attack this disease. But some of these rare diseases are based on the lack of some protein in our bodies. So they took the protein, and instead of producing the same protein and just giving this to the body, they identified the active site and with AI, and they produced the small protein. It's called peptide instead of the full protein. It turned out the peptide was more efficient and safer than the original protein, which was lacking in the body. So you can actually build something, a completely new, basically, molecule based on this protein, which was missing. And you know, they had a strong pipeline of such products, and they had amazing data. They raised $138 million round in 2022, end of 2022, when late stage round, when people thought that it's totally impossible to raise funds. So again, you see that if you do the right thing, you will raise, and they raised with a premium, it was not even a down round. So they raised at a premium, 138 million within 2 months. So great the data was. We actually invested last year. So we invested last year, most of our check. And this year there was an exit of over 1 billion and they sold to AstraZeneca. This was an exciting exit. We did like probably like up to five times on this investment over 3 years time frame. Also important to mention here that not all of these biotech are 10-year investments. So, you know, you see we just invested last year and we get exit this year. Like basically it's like a year or so. So it's all possible when you invest over the late stage. In health tech business, I also believe that you can identify those companies who can exit within 3 to 5 years, who can scale very fast. But the founders have to have this venture a mindset of a venture-backed company. It's very different to anything else. It's not great by far. It's maybe you have to make some compromises on the product itself, on many things. But if you play the game, you have to play the game. These are the rules. You have to grow exponentially. You don't grow like 20% each year. You grow 200%, 500%, like 1,000% each year. And this is what is expected. So if you like in your minds are building the company, which is a multi-billion companies. And I've seen a lot of founders who would say, well, you know, I'm not thinking about exit now. I'm building the product, and then you know, acquirers will come, and I'll next year we'll grow like at least 50%. No, 50% is not enough. You have to grow like 500% each year, and you have to think like it's like basically like a puzzle. You have to like solve the puzzle. How do you grow 1,000% next year? That's a question. And if you think like that, you will find a solution to this puzzle. And you will win as a VC-backed company for your investors. And once you win once, it will be very easy for you to fundraise your next startup. Maybe you will raise at a high valuation next time. So maybe you will skip the incubators, accelerators, maybe next time. But for now, if you do this for the first time, do the right thing and like really go through all the steps. Don't skip any step.
Well, thanks for all this advice. I mean, whenever we ask a question, there is at least like 10 advices from 10 pieces of advice from your side that perhaps we could we could put somewhere on a plaque, and you should like watch it every morning.
You should know it by heart.
If you are this startup, billion-dollar company mentality. But I also wanted to ask about something that is from the other side, not the startup side, but the in investment side, your side.
Right.
I had recently spoken to a guy who told me, well, I tried to set up a few startups. In the end, it didn't work out so well. But then I realized I want to be on the investment side because I understand what can go wrong about all the issues. And as you know, at least that's my experience, out of 10 projects that I initiate, only maybe one or two eventually make it and survive longer than a year. So perhaps my question would be about how to get into VC business, even though I have not worked for a big commercial bank, I have not had experience with your, US funds, etc. I'm just a humble startupper, but I still feel with all the social security and pension schemes vanishing soon because people, there are more and more people who are going to live longer and longer, and there won't be money to support us when we are old, poor things. So I thought, well, I could invest as an angel investor and maybe later on build a little VC fund. But now I'm intimidated and I say, oh, if there are VC funds like yours, there is no chance my little fund would be successful at all. So what would be your advice for those who want to make it or start their career or switch their career from a startup? Or maybe it doesn't have to be switching. It could be just I have the startup and on the side I want to, have my fingers in more pies, as the saying goes, and start investing. So what would be your recommendation? How to, provided I have not done anything, I'm not good with numbers. That's also a myth that I am really bad with numbers. And I spoke to this guy and said, well, there is no chance I can be a VC guy. And he told me, no, that's not true. You have the numbers people, and then you have the whatever, you have the Wozniaks and Jobs, even in investment funds. So what's your take on this? What's your advice?
Yeah, I would advise definitely to take revenge from a startupper like against the VC space, right? So, and change it this because the industry of VC space, by the way, haven't disrupted for some time. So we have never been disrupted probably for like decades. And yeah, so there are new people coming to the industry. Generally speaking, if you want to like enter the space and become a partner within a venture firm, existing venture firm, it's almost impossible, to be honest. It's almost impossible. I mean, firstly, they don't hire people normally. So they don't like put, some like vacancies, like whatever, like jobs. They don't post like a lot of jobs. So because the jobs are really scarce, basically it's like each fund, maybe, even like some mid-sized fund, there'll be like 3, 5, 7 people, 7, 5 partners, probably, that's it. There will be, by the way, not like hierarchical, so not like 5 partners, 20 like say like principals and 50 analysts. No, it's like 5 partners and say 1 or 2 analysts, and that's the whole like basically human resource within a venture firm. So it's really like even to get a job, like really find a job, find a vacancy, it's hard in the space. And then basically, there's a way how you can get into the space. So basically, you start as an angel investor, you get really a lot of investments, and some of them succeed. And then you actually decide whether you would like to build your own venture firm, or you will try to join somebody, because this may actually shorten your journey into the space. But this is first thing. So first thing, you have to be actively investing before you try to apply. And I've seen a lot of people who would say, well, I have like whatever, like biomedical background, or I have investment background, but they have never invested themselves. And, it's like, I would say it means that you're not really a believer in your own skills as an investor. So why would we actually invite you to join our firm? Secondly, so this is one way to get there. Another way is to get through major corporates. So within corporates, almost all the corporates now have venture arms or building their venture arms. And if you start and lead this effort, you can get like into the space as a partner or managing partner of such a corporate venture firm. And then if you're like leading this initial steps, then you can be leading the investment committee. Then, you know, so you can really get into the space, get all the skill set you need, and then start your own firm or join the other. This is another way. And third probably would be a way to get into accelerator as a mentor, as a like advisor. And then you have access to like hundreds of startups, you get relationships, you build them, and then you can monetize them getting into the space. So, you know, and that could be a mixture of all of these three ways how you can get into the space. And to be totally systematic as a professor, and I'm a professor, so I can tell you five skills which you need to show your experience if you want to get into VC space. So basically, first is sourcing. Sourcing, it means like finding the opportunities, which means you have to show that you either know, say like hundreds or many, at least many, universities, and you know scientists there, for example, and this is your exclusive source of deal flow, or you know other VC groups, you networked, you know all the other VC groups, you know the pipelines, you know what's happening, you can get access to this best deals in the space, and they are also scarce and in demand, basically, so you can have access to this companies, and you know maybe some others. So sourcing is number one. Secondly, you have to show that you can make due diligence and you can actually crunch numbers. Unfortunately, you have to. So I don't think you can really skip that. So you have to look through the information. You have to know the space very well. So you can come, for example, from a big pharma, from, you know, a healthcare IT company, or from big tech as well. You're saying, well, I have the expertise in AI, in healthcare regulations, whatever, so I can be like helpful. Again, you have to know all, you have to show like check marks for all of these skills, not just one. It's also a poker game. Then managing companies, managing, showing that as a mentor, you mentored companies, you know how they build value, you were somehow involved in building the team, for example, or advising how they should, you know, check the markets, whatever. So you have to show that you can manage and help them fundraise. So as a mentor, as advisor, from corporate, you know, whatever. So you were contributing to these companies. Also, you have to show. Then the fourth is exiting. Somehow, in some ways, like you have to say that you were somehow associated with some exit. I know that this is the most difficult part. I have 9 exits now, and this is really a differentiator. So most of the people like yourself, and you know your friend, they would not have experience in exiting. And this is basically the kind of, it happens like once in a lifetime, you know, some of the like super, like really high quality and famous even, you know, venture capitalists, they have 5 exits and it's already enough. You know, if you have an exit like Facebook or Zoom or whatever, that's enough. And Nvidia, that's good enough. That, with such one exit is enough. You know, and I had 9 and, you know, it's helpful. And then finally, again, you don't have to be like really like a partner who did this deal and who exited. You say, well, I was a mentor and there's a friend of mine who exited and I was very much involved. I was giving them some advice. So you have to find a way how you like really associate yourself with an exit. I think this is the really crucial. This sounds much stronger if you know how to exit. And finally, fundraising. You know, we are like a startup essentially, you know, we're also raising funds from limited partners, from our investors, and we have to pitch our fund, and you have to show that you have the relationships and you know how to pitch. It's nothing new to you. You're not kind of a scientist or somebody who you would not be able to show to the investors. So all of that, like 5 points, if you manage to, like, you should go like through all of them. And really act on each of them and find a way how you will show that you know how to do all of these 5 things. And if you show it, you know, that's like you have 1% chance to get into VC, more than 0. It's already good.
Thank you, Alan. Tomáš, you see, you have chances, and what I got from this
probably the guy who told you that you have chances, he didn't say the percentage. Sorry about that. I gave the percentage. I always give a percentage of the chance.
And obviously, to have exits, you need to invest, right? So right. It's a very simple formula. Thank you, Alan. And going back to digital health startups, you also mentioned that with this recent exit, this was a kind of AI startup, even in life science. And this is my question here. AI, is it a hype or is it like a disruption? But the question is not here, so question is more general. Do you think all this like hype, or like maybe opportunities or gaps they mention, they mean a lot, and maybe you can advise or envision anything that is specific to digital health? What is going on now and maybe in the future? What are the opportunities and also gaps in digital health, and what would you advise to maybe bright individuals or like young startups that they need to focus on, or should they maybe pay attention to all these like hypes or what? Yes. So,
they definitely should. So you should really like listen to all of these new technologies coming to the market, and also always think whether it's the right time for them. And then what are the triggers for you to start like implementing these technologies in your startup? Of course, you have to focus, and you the storyline should be very like short and say, well, we're doing this based on AI. So it can be based on AI, VR, and maybe sometimes it works. But then, you know, you have to really choose some, you know, some bets. You cannot be all, you know, sometimes I saw entrepreneurs who would use all the buzzwords in their like initial first sentence. They will put AI, XR, whatever, precision medicine, whatever. So, but I would say that that AI is definitely transforming the whole industry, this is by far the largest opportunity to do things, and you know, to basically tackle issues which were unresolved previously. You shouldn't apply AI to things which are, you know, quite resolved, like quite solved essentially. And some of these challenges were fundamental in digital health. For example, patient engagement. So patient engagement was always an issue. So you have great, amazing product, really, which measures something like with AI, you know, whatever. But then patients are not using that, you know, just because they feel healthy. At some point they feel healthy and they drop off, they churn from your solution, and you know that they have to stay. Like, it's not even about like selling them subscription, whatever. From the clinical benefit perspective, they should stay on this app for whatever, for a year, and they are staying just for like 2 weeks, you know, instead of a year. And of course, like business wise, you also care if they stay for a year or a couple of weeks too. Now with AI, you can personalize experience of the patient. You can make it much more engaging, and you know, you can basically talk with the patient, you know, as a chat. You know, you can have avatar, and we, one of our startup, which I'm actually CEO of, we're building this AI nurse. Now it's a chatbot, but at some point there will be like a digital, like a virtual copy of an actual nurse or physician which you work with, and this guy, you're really like the guy which you're talking with as an elderly person. He tells you, or she tells you, that you have to take the medication, and you feel much more obliged than just getting an alert, a text alert, you know, today, whatever, something. It's like a real person telling you that, you know, the weather is good today and you have to take your medication because of this, this and that. And we expect, and we actually tested that, people are much more engaged with the real, like with this kind of communication. And it's transformative. It's like only because of generative AI you can do that. And then if you talk about machine learning and all of that, of course you can identify patterns in the data of patients. Now that we're collecting a lot of data of patients, especially at home, now you can identify some patterns which you cannot identify, you know, as a physician, you know, just because, you know, you cannot find the correlations between, say, like 50 variables, right? So now with AI, you can find out something completely new, and you can actually even not know what stands behind it, what's the logic behind it. It's just showing that this pattern like continues to like this or whatever, like using vector search or some newest technologies, which by the way, InterSystems is building and giving this to startups, these technologies, you can identify patterns which you would be unable to identify otherwise. And sometimes, unfortunately, we don't know the logic behind. We may recreate at some point this logic and some thinking behind that. But first you have to identify this through data. It's completely different ways how you approach that. And I'm very much excited. Another company which I'm involved in and invested into, they use AI for pharmacogenetics. Pharmacogenetics, you know, choosing the right drugs, dosages, evaluating drug-drug interactions. This is like a very old story. But now, using AI, you can collect real-world evidence, like really what actually happened to patients, not like theoretically. You can find that, well, you know, we recommended they have to lower the dose, but the guy actually had a side effect still, even with a lower dose. And now, you know, we didn't recommend, obviously. The startup doesn't, the regulation doesn't allow us to recommend. We do something like some data for the physician, and then physician can actually think about that and make his or her own recommendations. But using this vector search, we can identify patterns and see, well, you know what? You actually have to lower those much more than that, because you have, say, you know, 700 different kind of polymorphisms in your genome, which, you know, no physicians can overview. It's impossible. It's only because of this machine learning stuff, which can identify things. And this is truly amazing. So in terms of precision medicine, home care, patient engagement, many other things, you know, we'll see like a completely different healthcare than we have today. And, you know, this is really a revolution. And I would advise everybody to join this revolution from the startup world, from investors as well. We as investors, we join it. I wish that all the startups would find a way how AI affects their own story.
Alan,
in a meaningful way, I would need to say, in a meaningful way.
Alan, you are amazing, because most speakers, they gradually lose energy during a podcast, but not your case. You know, you love your job, and you love to convey the message to everybody, and it's amazing. But we are gradually approaching the end, because there is time limit to everything, including our lives. And it's great true that we are all facing a major exit at the end. So in a way,
we will change that. We will change that, by the way.
Yeah, but still, you know, that's the ultimate exit that counts. But if you said you are going to change that, maybe we could spend a few minutes talking about future. But I mean a more distant future, not just next year, but let's say 10 years. So what technology or system change or disruption do you think is going to happen in 10 years' time? And I know it's very hard to make predictions. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, you know, with my kids or at work. But still, I'd like to ask you if you could attempt, give it a try to, you know, to look into a crystal ball.
Yeah, so funny enough, you know, people think of some like gene therapies that will reprogram our genes to live like longer, or whatever. This may happen. You know, we may actually cut our heads and put it on a like newer body, a younger body, maybe like probably not in 10 times in 10 years from now, but maybe like in 20 or whatever. It's actually possible. And then funny enough, some of these innovations, firstly, they exist today. They are not adopted. That's the issue. And secondly, really funny that some of the major impacts would come from digital health, not from gene therapies, not from like really digital health, really like, you know, medication adherence. This is like, this will change this world completely, or like pharmacogenomics, which would be AI powered, would change the world completely. So like precision medicine, like really monitoring people at home, not at home, generally in their lifetime, you know, like monitoring when they are healthy, not monitoring when they are sick. You know, this whole like shift from sick care, which we have today, to healthcare. And I know this, like people, like a lot of people say the same thing, but this is really a radical shift, which will happen with the next 10 years. And the only thing which stops it is basically inertia of major health systems. It's not like, it's not that, you know, they are bad actors. They are all like, they are really like providing health to the patients. This is their job. It's not their job to innovate, to put whatever, some like to care about the people at home so far. But now that we have reimbursement, now that the Medicare and now the agencies in Europe as well are actually paying for that since COVID times, now health systems can benefit from home care as well. And they can actually connect like their inpatient services with outpatient setting, with hospital at home solutions, so they can complement that. And this shift in the mindset, it takes time, unfortunately. And we just had COVID, by the way. We just had it like 3 years ago. So it's like very recent development that people actually started doing telehealth at scale. It was like 5% or less, and now it's 40% or more of like visits which are coming through telehealth. And then we didn't have data. We didn't have standards like FHIR standard to exchange data. So there were a lot of prerequisites which were non-existent just 3 to 5 years ago. And now we're living through this revolution when it's been reimbursed by Medicare, by the state, by the insurers, when they see the clinical benefit of this. And we will see that the outcomes would get much, much better. Just because of this, like stupid, like not like gene therapists, like really through this very straightforward innovation, like really monitoring some of these parameters of human organism. That's more than enough to prevent some of the issues which we are like going through today. It's much better to basically prevent and predict some conditions and intersect with cancer. We may not cure cancer in 5-10, at least all the cancers, but we may actually prevent them. Many cancers we can prevent and basically intercept when they are at the very early stages. And for that, we would need digital health. That's why, you know, the people who are in the space, I think they will see a lot of value being created by themselves and by their fellow entrepreneurs and investors in the space.
Mm-hmm. Alan, thank you so much. And as Tomasz mentioned that we are close to the exit.
Yeah.
It's exciting digital health innovation podcast. And obviously, so you shared so much insights today, and I believe there are much more stay within you, so we don't have other way that, but invite you again very soon.
Sure.
This, for Celestino's podcast. But today's question is, maybe we didn't ask you what you wanted to share with the audience. Maybe you have something.
I would say just one single advice, my final advice for you, which I think the most important, like single piece of advice: do what is right and do not do what is wrong. I think this is the last and very important advice which I can it's like single piece of advice which I can give to you, which means but that you have to be fundamental. You have to think what is right, really, for your startup, for you, and don't make too many compromises. So I mentioned that you have to adjust to trends, whatever. It's more about communication. It's more about like implementing some of these technologies which make sense, but never compromise on the core, what you're building, not compromise on your passion, because you will definitely fail if you don't have the passion for your startup. So you will, you know, by the way, when I meet a founder and I don't see passion in the eyes, you know, it's nothing. It's I don't like that. It's kind of soft skills thing, and you cannot imitate that. You know, when you see a person which is like genuinely interested in what he's doing, he or she is doing, you know, you will feel it. And again, this, you have to, you know, you have to have a combination, like in addition to this passion, because you can, with passion, you can do wrong things as well. And finally, of course, I mentioned already that, you know, you will fail like a lot, you know, many things will fail, like everything, but stay calm. It's usual. Everybody fails. You know, everything which can fail, in your startup will actually fail, and you will have to, you know, to find a way how you overcome things and overcome issues. But in the end, if you stay calm you will succeed in the long run. So you have to find way how you stay calm. Maybe you will do yoga, maybe you do running. So find a way, your actual hobby, to stay calm and excited about what you're doing. Yeah, that's my final advice to you. And I would love to join your podcast sometime in the future as well. Because there's so many things happening right now and there's so many adjustments and really progress being made. So I would love to share this as you go along with your podcast.
Yes, thank you, Alan. And this was a really great advice. Don't do wrong, do right. And I hope,
yes.
And it also, right, speaking, addressing our audience, do right thing, subscribe for this podcast.
That's the right thing, yes.
Yeah.
And Alan, also, somehow this is in line with the motto of Celestino's Incubator, which is do good and do it well. So we didn't rehearse, and still we ended up at the same point. Goodness is what the world needs, with passion, combined with passion. But it's been great chatting with you. Thank you so much. Our podcast, we call it, you know, Digital Health Innovation, but it's for all those that are either coming from the startup side, investment side, professional side, physicians and healthcare professionals that want to, you know, build a startup or maybe act as mentors, for anyone who is into health tech, med tech, and is ready to passionately do good and do it well. So I'm looking forward to meeting you again soon, and to all of you who have been listening and watching us, we'll be back soon, and stay tuned for more passion and for more good in the digital health arena. So this has been Evgeny. So a big clap to Evgeny, big clap to Alan and Thomas from Celestino's podcast. See you soon. Bye, guys.
See you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.